This is Michael Feldman. I was at a public radio event one time when Ira Glass, taking a break from being fawned over, sidled up to me and said, "So you once interviewed David Foster Wallace, huh?" "Yep. But I have to say, while I really enjoyed talking to him, and I hope he said he was nervous, I feel it was a missed opportunity, mostly devoted to a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again." This is a book where he traveled to the Illinois State Fair and took a cruise and such for Harper's, and for money, I suppose. There was only a fleeting reference to Infinite Jest, the heft of, and the footnotes, or endnotes, actually, as he said. I had plowed about a third of the way into Jest by then, but let's just say it still takes up a considerable portion of my nightstand. Loved brief interviews with hideous men, which this was not. David was extremely nice for a guy so brilliant. Loved Consider the Lobster, etc., and made a real go at the posthumous Pale King, even though it was about the Infernal Revenue. I guess trying to make up for the too jokey interview, even if he did come out on top on those exchanges. A very funny guy. From What Do You Know, on April 5th, 1997, David Foster Wallace.
You know, there's a book just out now called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. The author is probably talked about more than any young author in the country right now, actually. David Foster Wallace, who probably best known for this book here, Infinite Jest, which is called, in the business, a 10-pounder. It's a good one. I've got about an inch into it, but I have read the other one, Supposedly Fun Thing. It's a collection of essays he's done, I think, mostly for Harper's. And would you welcome, please, on the phone with us from Bloomington, Illinois, David Foster Wallace. What a polite crowd. Isn't that nice?
Are there people actually there with you?
No, actually, these are all sound effects. This is all digitalized, basically. I'm sitting here alone in my room.
My nervousness is now tripled.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. They're all from around here. And you're from around here. You're Midwestern, aren't you?
Yeah, I think Illinoisans try to draw a rather sharp distinction between ourselves and Wisconsin people.
Yeah, we do too. We feel the same way from the other side of the world.
We'll get along fine.
Yeah, but did you go to school at Northern? Or?
No, I went to school out of state. I grew up in Champaign, which is where the U of I is.
Yeah. Urbana-Champaign, they call it now. When did they change it from Champaign-Urbana? I was kind of shocked to hear about that.
I don't know. We've always called it Champaign-Urbana, but then on the rare times when the U of I would get televised in sports, they'd call it Urbana-Champaign. I think it scans poetically better if you put Urbana first or something.
It does? To you? I mean, you're the author. You're the poet.
Yeah, I don't write a whole lot of poetry, but...
Yeah, but you know words. I mean, to me, Champaign should be before Urbana. Let's say just a quick one. Champaign-Urbana or Urbana-Champaign? Champaign-Urbana. And how many of you say Nina Menashe? Get out of here, you're in the wrong show.
Well, clearly you've got this crowd behind you. And
yeah, they're behind. Yeah. The sooner they're behind me, the better, I think, is given the monologue. I mean, how are you, David?
Well.
How are you dealing with all this fame? Now, you're in everybody's literary lips these days.
I think the amount of people whose lips, you know, talk about literary stuff is small enough so that I think it's sort of like being... It's the amount of fame equivalent to being a small market TV weatherman. So I've been bearing up surprisingly well.
But the people who talk about you write about you too. So I mean, so you do get a lot of press and so forth. And do you get tired of being a representative of a generation or another, one generation or another?
Well, the nice thing about it, there's a silliness about the whole thing that keeps one from taking it seriously. I get called a Gen X writer, but I was born in 1962, so demographically I'm a baby boomer.
You're a late boomer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very witty of you.
Yeah. Thank you. Because I'm an early boomer. I'm 49.
There's medication for that, you know.
There's what?
Nothing.
I'm taking it, Claritin, but it's not enough. It really doesn't go to the root of
it. It was a premature ejaculation pun. So.
Oh! I'm sorry, I missed that.
No, that's fine.
But
I was trying to get in the witty.
Who told you about that? I was tired, though, you know. Anyway, the whole boomer thing is ridiculous because, why? Has it always, did they call Mark Twain a representative of his generation, you know, when he wrote? Doesn't that seem to be like a modern preoccupation, like you got to represent your entire demographic if you do something?
You want a joke or you want the serious thing?
Yeah, no, go ahead. Give me either one. I don't care.
My guess is, I think things are so confusing now and there's so much information and we're so awash in the stuff that we look for ways to pigeonhole and categorize stuff, including ourselves, and I think it's one reason. The whole Gen X thing, I think, you know, Infinite Jest, I got some caller on a radio show asking if I was the voice of a generation, and you know, Generation X is defined as not having a voice.
Right.
You know, as having no unity. So the whole thing is just very strange.
Yeah, it is pretty strange. And I certainly don't represent anything except, you know, early middle age onset. Actually, it's not early at this point. It's, you know, but it's demographically, I guess it would be. And a supposedly fun thing. Now, they sent you to, for example, Harper's. Mostly it's written for Harper's?
Yeah, most of them were written for Harper's. And then because of the Harper's pieces, I got sweet little assignments from a couple other magazines. But, yeah.
So, like, when they send you to the Illinois State Fair, are you supposed to come back with a witty, ironic thing that Eastern readers can relate to about Midwestern yokels? Or?
Well, that was the stance adopted in the piece, although I don't think the yokels was really I don't think it was particularly mean to the Midwest. Harper's is actually fiendishly clever. What they do is they give you really no instructions at all.
Wow.
They send you there and say, do the best you can, and you end up getting really anxious, and I guess the anxiety translates into a certain amount of wit.
Yes.
Like, for instance, early boomer.
Yeah, certain amount. A modest amount. Well, you know, it's like monkeys and typewriters. I don't mean your writing. But
well, the comparison's been made.
No, I don't think so. Except the footnotes. Now let me ask you something. You write a book that's 700 some pages. Why do you need footnotes at that point? Couldn't you cram all that in there without the footnotes?
Well, there are certain reasons for. They're actually endnotes, not footnotes. And
I'm sorry.
You know, other than throwing a lot of French literary terms at you and sounding really absurd and pretentious, I'll just go ahead and let you have made your shot. I think there's a fairly good reason for them. The problem is they get kind of addictive, and you can see in the book of essays, the ones that were written before I started Infinite Jest don't have footnotes, and then the footnotes get kind of more and more extreme as the book goes on.
Well, do you ever throw anything away?
I'm sorry?
Do you ever throw anything away when you write, or you just put into a footnote?
You're being obliquely mean here.
I'm not. I'm just... No, you're an excellent writer. I enjoy your writing, actually your footnotes are interesting too. But I'm wondering, you know, if it was a footnote, couldn't we have just crumpled that one? And
all right. One of the advantages I personally now have declared a footnote ban, so I'm not using footnotes anymore. But that's nothing against footnotes.
No.
I just lost control of them. I think a footnote, at least for me, I rarely like. For instance,
these are endnotes, actually, by the way. But that's. It's a small point.
No, when this interview is done, the second voice in my head will take over, and I will begin thinking of all the stuff I should have said and, you know, witty sallies that I should have said.
Well, I do that, too. I've got the whole
thing. I mean, most of my consciousness is sort of doubled, and one of the neat things about having a footnote is it's a way to get kind of a double consciousness or a sort of call and response on the page. The irritation quotient is fairly low, and so I think you've got to be fairly careful how much of that you make the reader slog through. Some people have suggested that I sort of overshot the mark. I think there are reasons for it other than just, I do actually throw a surprising amount of stuff away. There's reasons for it other than just to sort of record every thought that shoots across my consciousness.
Yeah, you're not like that guy who keeps a diary of everything he does during the day for the past 40 years.
That diary is actually supposed to be kind of cool. Mine wouldn't be, I don't think. So.
Yeah. Well, he records his stools. Now, we had the guy on, actually. You know, like the quality of them and the quantity and so forth. So
actually, stools would constitute some of the more interesting parts of my day. It's just much of my day could be given over to. No, I mean, both of those books, you know, at least 20% was cut by me and the editor of both of those books. So
yeah.
I get irked when reviewers suggest that it's like padded or, you know, first draft and stuff like that.
No, I don't think it is at all.
I wasn't suggesting you were one of the people.
I know, but you accused me of being some kind of mean before. But I,
now we'll lapse into this sort of politeness roulette.
No, I love your work. I really do. I know you love mine, too.
Yeah. Well, I've actually listened to your show, although I got very anxious because I know there's a quiz element, and I thought I was going to be quizzed.
No, you're not on the quiz.
I was reassured about that, yeah.
Yeah, it just seems that way. You know, I like the State Fair piece, the thing about the baton twirlers is funny. I mean, all the damage that gets done during one of those exhibitions.
None of that was made up.
Yeah.
This is nonfiction.
But you had a guy who caught one in the groin in the audience? Or?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. The really bad ones were when people in the top rows would take one and then fall over on people in the lower row.
And we've all seen this at the State Fair. But was that the highlight for you at the fair, or was that where they dangled the guy from the crane, and that was kind of a nice scene, too?
The Sky Coaster was probably the highlight, although you know, the high would be, you'd have to. Probably the highlight for me was this thing called clogging, mm-hmm. which I always thought was like a kind of Jed Clampett, you know, goony people in boots, real slow, and it turns out it's much more like this thing, River Dance, which is now sort of ubiquitous on
PBS. Yeah, driving me nuts now.
Very fast and very cool, and there's no kind of hideous Michael Flatley sort of ego person at the front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it needs that, though.
Is there clogging in Wisconsin?
We have clogging in Wisconsin, don't we? We have probably cloggers here. How many of you clog? Well, not. They were here earlier, but they're off.
I see.
They're off now. They clicked their way out of the room. But some of them do wear wooden shoes, but I think it's pretty...
Well, no. I mean, it just turns out it's sort of like country tap dancing on methamphetamine. And,
right.
Which
is another fair event
they should
have.
I thought it was very, very cool.
Yeah.
That was probably the highlight for me.
Yeah. Did you find... I like the part where they got this guy from the east and they put him up on a crane and dangled him from his feet and swung him.
This was this thing called the Sky Coaster, which, as far as I could see, was supposed to mimic, you know, kind of a near-death experience. I don't think they knew he was from the East Coast. He was wearing aviator glasses and Banshee loafers, which, for me, suggested he was either, you know, from Wisconsin or from the East Coast.
Or from the East Coast of Wisconsin. Like
exactly.
Sort of the hip region there, right along the lake. It's hip for about a mile inland. It's the lake effect.
Sort of Greenwich Village with a lot of snow.
Well, not exactly, but we do have pollen and allergies here, I'll tell you that. Yeah, it was cool. It was like they picked this guy out of the crowd because he looked wrong, and they dangled him from his feet above the crowd. I thought that was...
And swung him back and forth at a height of about 100 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what's interesting kind of is at these fairs and things, you do have the two crowds. You have the husbandry crowd.
Yeah.
The people who are there with the animals, for the animals, and so the animals shall not perish from the earth. And then you have the city folk who are out there for the midway stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't mix.
Well, and then you've got a whole third venue, which is the people who go to the expo. I don't know if the Wisconsin Fair is an expo, but these are people who,
you betcha,
you know, have toilet paper with jokes on them and, you know, T-shirts that, like, I go from zero to horny in 2.5 beers.
Yeah. Right.
And if any of the people are wearing that T-shirt in the audience, I hasten to apologize, but it's just, no.
This is a public radio audience.
The weird thing is the three different crowds seem to have very little to do with each other. You know, you never saw the Midway people at the agriculture stuff, and you never saw the expo people in the Midway.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting.
Every bad bumper sticker comes from those things.
Yeah. It was fascinating because I'd wondered, you know, where this stuff comes from, mm-hmm. you know. And it comes from State Fair Expos.
Yeah. But, you know, there are those kids who come there with their... I always wondered about the farm kids, like 4-H kids who come there with their little heifer, you know, and they sleep with that. I mean, those kids, like, sleep with... I mean, they nest there with... They sleep with it and they in the barn and see that nothing happens to it. They brush it. They, you know, and the thing's immaculate for a heifer. It's a clean heifer.
No, here was the horrible thing. Because it's really kind of sweet. I mean, these kids, they do sleep with their animals, and they sleep with their animals because they have to get up at like 4, you know, to start the training. The horrible thing was these sweet little freckle-faced gap-toothed kids trying terribly hard to win ribbons, and on the judges' rostrum are sitting three guys in string ties, and it turns out they are from meat companies, which buy the winners. And it wasn't at all clear from the kids' faces that they knew, you know, what was going on. You know, congratulations, you get $1,000 and, you know, Daisy's going to be chopped up for hamburger.
Yeah. Man here from Armor Star wants to talk with you and give you a little ribbon.
Yeah. That was what lent kind of the tragic air to the whole thing.
Yeah. And then there's the carnies. I mean, there's a book. Has someone done the book on carnies yet? I suppose someone has.
Harry Cruz has a thing in a book called Biography of a Place about sort of his relationship with carnies, but I don't think so. Uh-huh. I just thought they were scary.
And they're the same guys who, they come up here to Wisconsin, I don't know, before or after Illinois.
Yeah, Wisconsin is right after Illinois, so they're pretty well hungover, I imagine, by the time they get up to you.
They're in some continuous state. I can't figure out what it is. I never really talked with one of the guys. Did you get to know any carnies while doing this piece?
I actually, for a couple of days, went with an old girlfriend who turned out to be really pretty, and she was able to talk to the carnies without much problem. They were not terribly interested in me.
Oh,
brandishing my press credentials at them and asking them, you know, deep questions and stuff.
That's good. And I guess the one thing you couldn't do was the chicken house, huh? The chicken barn.
I have chicken issues.
Yeah, you know? Chicken issues. You were pecked?
I was pecked.
All right.
I was pecked.
Say no more.
I really, really don't even think I could talk about it without a supportive person here.
Yeah, and we don't really have one at the moment.
This I can tell.
Yeah, Jim's the closest we got, and he hasn't been a lot of help to me.
Chicken or scary? It's actually now, I live near a slaughterhouse, and my second date with my current girlfriend, we went to watch a cow get slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask.
Yeah.
But I can't eat red meat anymore, but I can, however, gleefully eat chicken.
Yeah. And are you going out with her?
Yeah, we're actually still together. The quality of the dates, I think, has increased. She sort of pointed out to me that this was probably not a good early date.
Yeah. Her suggestion,
I got sick, and she's like, well, let's go get some breakfast. And so. so I ended up not looking very manly.
Interesting girl, I must say. Or young woman, excuse me. Now, this other thing here, basically, though, I like your take sort of on this, what we call the irony, this rampant irony that's sweeping over the country. How's that for metaphors? I could write books like this, huh? And I'd footnote that, explaining what I tried to say right there, and giving examples.
So you're going to ask me a deeply ironic question about
irony? Yeah, let's forget it. Let's forget that whole thing. Now this chicken house. Let's go back to that. And then they sent you on a cruise, too, the same people. And the object there was to see how much you could be pampered?
The object there was, you know, once again, they give no instructions,
yeah.
Which I think they figured out works well for me because I get so terrified that I'm not going to do a good piece that I end up paying really close attention to everything.
Mm-hmm.
The object there, I think, was to sort of talk about what a cruise was like, and I guess because the cruise is sort of the ultimate fantasy vacation, to talk a little bit about Americans' relationship to pleasure. It mm-hmm. sounds incredibly lame, you know, talking about it this way, but...
Okay, we can talk about something else.
No, I'm talking about my description, not your question.
Oh, thank you. But, I live in dread of taking a cruise. You know, I mean, there's a certain point in your life where you feel, you know, appropriate that you take a cruise, but what do? You eat 12 times a day, and you're on the ocean, and you know what it does to your system. I mean,
yeah.
You know, probably third day out, you can have a movement, possibly.
It's there's all sorts of problems. The biggest problem is, I don't know if you're like me, I have a really hard time having fun any time that somebody, like, gets in my face, grabs me by the lapels, and screams, "We're having fun now." You know, and the cruise ship has all sort of these Julie McCoy figures whose entire job is to walk around with high-watt smiles, sort of exorting you about how much fun you're having.
Right, and then they never come back.
And I just get, I stick my lower lip out then and decide I'm going to show them and I'm not going to have fun. And,
well, what fun is there? You got to dance? It's like ballroom dancing, isn't it? I mean, you got Arthur Murray style ballroom dancing. Is that the main?
There was pretty much every kind of fun venue, illegal, you know, and moral fun venue available. Some of it was a bit cheesy, you know, the electric slide, the kind of cheesy Borscht Belt stand up comedy. But a lot of it was fairly fun. I mean, there was fun ping pong, there was fun shuffleboard, there were impromptu sort of art sales. There was an entire art sale that consisted of an auction of Leroy Neiman prints. Not original Leroy Neiman. Leroy Neiman prints, and the bidding
couch
was
art,
spirited.
Man.
You know?
Sofa art. And you don't have your sofa there, so you don't know how long the painting is supposed to be. That
exactly.
Would be the, the other thing I want to mention, you know, I have met David Lynch.
Have you?
At a party.
Uh-huh.
You know, he has a house here in Madison. No one knows where it is. But
really?
For some reason, we don't know why, but he has a house. I don't think he's ever in it. But I met him at a party, and I was so awestruck, I couldn't say a word. It was one of my major great moments. He said something about English, about chimneys in England or something. It was my lead-in, and I was ready to say something. And then I thought he'd say, "Oh, so you've been to England," and then I'd be stuck, you know,
right.
In those situations. So I said nothing. But is Lynch a hero of yours?
He's a hero in kind of a weird way. I don't like all of his films, but the ones that I like a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
The neat thing about the Lynch piece, I mean, I never had to talk to him. I sort of orbited him, you know, and watched him from like 10 feet away, but I would have immediately wet myself, I think, if he'd come up and wanted to.
I did that too, but I left that out of the description.
Yeah.
He said something about English people living in their fireplaces or something, and I thought, well, there's a Lynchian...
Yeah.
I could see that, you know, people coming out from the fireplace.
Yeah.
Like the radiator thing.
He's a man who's pretty completely unironic. I mean, if he said that, I don't think he meant it as a joke.
Yeah, probably there are English people living in fireplaces.
He's a man for whom the adjective keen is sort of the highest praise you can give something. And so it's very weird, you know, to hear somebody speak that way and then to see, you know, homicidal dwarves, you know, eviscerating people on the screen and stuff. His house, by the way, in L.A., the house that's in... Lost Highway, that's Bill Pullman's and Roseanne Arquette's house, is two houses down from his house.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. He got some neighbor to, like, move out and let him use his house.
That's cool. And I haven't seen this latest movie, but you seem pretty enthusiastic about it.
I was enthusiastic about the rough cut. I'm afraid the movie itself is kind of a dink.
Really?
I went and saw it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I look a bit stupid in the essay.
So the paperback will have a few more footnotes in
it.
Yeah.
Very kind of you.
Yeah. Well, just the use of Richard Pryor, though. And you talk about, you know, the problem I have with David Lynch is, if he's not ironic, I mean, the things that he portrays, and what is his take on it, basically? You know, the severed ear being the classic one with the fly on it, you know.
Right.
That was cool the first time you see it.
Yeah.
But then you see, like in this Wild at Heart or something, there was, you say, we're people of color in his movies.
Yeah.
There was a black man in that movie. He got his head bashed in graphically in that movie. And I think, all right, when is this going to stop? Why is this happening, and when is it going to stop? And then there was a dog carrying someone's head around or something.
I believe it was an arm. Yeah, somebody gets their arm shot off with a shotgun. Yeah, Wild at Heart, I think, is probably his worst movie.
Yeah. And so what are we supposed to think about all that? I mean, if we're just – he's looking at things as objects, right, basically?
I think in a certain way. Like in Lost Highway, Richard Pryor's got a cameo part, and it's really disturbing because, of course, he's not the Richard Pryor we remember. He's Richard Pryor with, you know, MS. And he's in a wheelchair, and he looks like he weighs about 8 pounds. And the movie itself is sort of about, you know, identity. Two people are actually, you know, one person really changes into another. So kind of theoretically, it's interesting to have Richard Pryor. You know, he both is and isn't the Richard Pryor we remember. But the big thing about it is it just seems like it's mean. Mm. You know, and I'll bet Richard Pryor didn't know that he was on there to be some kind of weird, damaged object for theoretical scrutiny. I mean, I'll bet he thought he was being hired to act. And so Lynch, there's a coldness and a meanness about Lynch that I don't like, and that also kind of fascinates me, because I think, you know, we like to watch sadism from a distance.
Yeah, and plus he's so good at it.
Yeah.
There are things going on. You don't know why they affect you the way they do in his movies, but they do. You know,
yeah.
There's some weird element there.
They're a lot like dreams, I think, and they make us vulnerable sort of the way dreams do.
Yeah. So how's your tennis game? Still good?
My tennis game is not all that strong. I got hurt in my late 20s, and I'm not as mobile as I'd like to be, but I still play just for fun.
Yeah, and I actually love the description of your tennis days, your Midwestern tennis days, where you play the wind and you play the cracks in the court, right?
Is that pretty much? Yeah, if you learn how to play in rural Illinois, you play it as it lies.
Yeah, and the wind is a big factor.
Big one.
David, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you for taking time.
I hope it hasn't been too painful.
No, it was fun.
The book is called The Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, by David Foster Wallace. Thanks, David.
Okay.